This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Killing Commendatore by Haruki Murakami. Translated from the Japanese by Philip Gabriel and Ted Goosen. Read for you by Kirby Hayborn. Chapter 21. It's small, but should you cut with it, blood will certainly come out. I sat upright in bed, and in the dark of night I held my breath and listened to the sound of the bell. Where could the sound be coming from? It was louder than before and clearer, no doubt about it, and it was coming from an entirely new direction. The bell was ringing inside this house. I could come to no other conclusion, and from a jumble of memories came the recollection that the bell had been resting on a shelf in my studio for a few days. After we uncovered that hole, I'd put the bell there myself. The sound of the bell was coming from the studio. Absolutely no doubt. But what should I do? I was shaken and scared. Something truly weird was taking place inside this house, under the same roof. It was the middle of the night, in an isolated house in the mountains, and I was all alone. I couldn't help but be afraid. When I thought about it later, I think my confusion surpassed my fear at that point. The human brain is probably constructed that way. All the emotions and feelings you have are mobilized to blunt or mitigate fear and distress. Like at a fire, where every single container that can hold water is put to use. I tried to gather my thoughts and figure out what to do. One choice was to pull the covers over my head and go back to sleep. The method Masahiko advocated, to ignore the inexplicable. Switch your mind off. See nothing. Hear nothing. The problem was, there was no way I could go back to sleep. Even if I put my head under the covers, stopped up my ears, and switched off my mind, there was no way I could ignore the bell when it rang out this clearly, because it was ringing inside this very house. As always, the bell rang intermittently a few times, then came a short silence, then the bell rang out again. The silence in between was never uniform, each time a little shorter or longer than before. There was a strange human feel to that lack of uniformity. The bell wasn't ringing by itself. No device was being used to ring it. Someone was holding it and ringing it. It was sending out a message. If I can't escape it, then all I can do is get the facts. If this keeps up, then I'll never get to sleep and my life will be totally upended. I decided to take the initiative and find out what was happening in the studio. A bit of anger was included in this. Why did I have to go through this? And of course, there was a dash of curiosity thrown in as well. I wanted to be certain, with my own eyes, what was going on here. I got out of bed and threw on a cardigan over my pajamas. I grabbed a flashlight and went out to the front entrance. I grabbed the oak walking stick that Tomohiko Amada had left behind in an umbrella stand, a sturdy, heavy stick. I didn't think it would be useful, but holding something in my hand bucked up my courage. I had to be ready for anything. Needless to say, I was scared. I was barefoot, but could barely feel the floor. My body was stiff, as if every bone in my body creaked with each step. Someone must have snuck into the house, and that someone was ringing the bell. And it must be the same person who was ringing the bell at the bottom of the hole. Who, or what, that was, I couldn't predict. Was it a mummy? Say I set foot in the studio and really did confront a mummy, a shriveled up man the color of beef jerky, shaking the bell. How should I react? Smack him with Tomohiko Amada's walking stick? No way, I thought. I can't do that. The mummy would have to be a Buddhist priest who'd mummified himself. We weren't talking about a zombie. Okay, so what should I do? I was still confused, or rather, my confusion had grown worse. If I had no good way of dealing with the situation, did that mean I'd have to resign myself to sharing the house with a mummy? Putting up with that bell at the same time every night? I suddenly thought of Minshiki. This problem had arisen because of him, because he'd done things he shouldn't have, because he'd used heavy equipment to move the stone mound and uncover the mysterious hole. Some unknown being had entered this house along with the bell. I thought of calling him. Despite the late hour, I could picture him rushing over in his Jaguar, but I gave up the idea. I didn't have time to wait for him to get ready and drive over. I had to do something right here and right now. I had to make this my responsibility. I steeled myself and stepped into the living room and turned on the light. Even with the light on, the bell kept on ringing. I could clearly hear it coming from beyond the door leading into the studio. I re-gripped the walking stick in my right hand, tiptoed across the large living room, and put my hand on the doorknob of the studio door. I took a deep breath, made up my mind, and turned the knob. As if waiting for me to do that, the second I pushed open the door, the bell stopped cold. A deep silence descended. The studio was pitch black, and I couldn't see a thing. I reached out to the left-hand wall, fumbled for the light switch, and snapped it on. The pendant light on the ceiling came on, and the room was suddenly bathed in light. I stood, legs shoulder-width apart, walking stick in hand, ready to respond to anything, and quickly scanned the room. The tension made my throat so parched that I could hardly swallow. No one was in the studio. No shriveled-up mummy ringing the bell. No one was there. There was the easel standing by itself in the middle of the room with a canvas on it. In front of the easel was the old three-legged wooden stool. That was all. The studio was deserted. I couldn't hear a single insect. There was no wind. The white curtain hung down at the window, the whole scene bathed in an unearthly silence. The walking stick was shaking. I was so tense. As it shook, the tip of the stick made an irregular click against the floor. The bell was still on the shelf. I went over and studied it carefully. I didn't pick the bell up, but I didn't see anything different about it. It was the same as when I'd picked it up in the afternoon and returned it to the shelf, with no evidence of having been moved. I sat on the stool in front of the easel and once more scanned the room, examining every inch of it, but I still didn't see anyone. It was the same scene I was used to. The painting on the easel was the rough sketch I'd begun of the man with the white Subaru Forester. I glanced at the clock on the shelf. It was exactly 2 a.m. It was 1:35, as I recall, when the bell woke me up, so 25 minutes had passed. It didn't feel like that much time had passed. It felt more like 5 or 6 minutes. My sense of time was messed up, or else the passage of time itself was messed up. One of the two. I gave up, got down from the stool, turned off the light in the studio, went out, and shut the door. I stood in front of the closed door for a while, my ears perked up, but couldn't hear the bell anymore. I couldn't hear anything, only the silence. Hearing silence, this was no play on words. On an isolated mountaintop, silence had a sound. I stood there before the door to the studio and listened to that sound. Just then, I noticed something on the sofa in the living room I hadn't seen before. It was as big as a cushion or a doll, but I had no memory of putting it there. I looked closer and saw it was no cushion or doll. It was a small, living person, about 2 feet tall. That little person was wearing odd-looking white clothes, and he was squirming around like he was uncomfortable in his outfit. I'd seen that ancient traditional garb before, the kind a high-ranking person would have worn in ancient times in Japan. And it wasn't just the clothes. I remembered the person's face, too. The Commendatore. My body felt frozen, as if a fist-sized lump of ice were slowly crawling up my spine. The Commendatore from the painting Killing Commendatore was sitting on the sofa in my house, or more precisely, Tomohiko Amada's house, and looking straight at me. The little man was dressed exactly like in the painting, with the same face, as if he'd escaped directly from the painting. I tried to recall where I'd put it. That's right, I remembered. It was in the guest bedroom. Not wanting anyone visiting the house to see it, I'd wrapped it in brown washi paper and had hidden it there. If this man had escaped, then what had happened to the painting? Was it solely the Commendatore who had vanished from the canvas? But was that possible? That a person in a picture could escape from it? Of course not. That's impossible. Obviously, no matter what anybody might think. I stood there, rooted to the spot, the thread of logic lost, random thoughts racing through my head as I gazed at the Commendatore on the sofa. Time temporarily stopped moving forward, shifting back and forth as if waiting for my confusion to subside. I couldn't take my eyes off that bizarre character. All I could think was that he had somehow come from the spirit world. For his part, the Commendatore stared up at me from the sofa. I had no words, and was silent. The shock must have done it. I was capable of nothing other than to keep my eyes on him and breathe, my mouth slightly ajar. The Commendatore didn't take his eyes off me either, and he didn't say a word. His lips were shut tight. On the sofa, he flung his short legs out straight in front of him. He leaned back against the sofa, though his head didn't reach to the top. On his feet were oddly shaped shoes. They seemed made out of black leather, the tips pointed and curled upward. At his waist he wore a long sword with a decorated shaft. A long sword, yet of a size to fit his build, so actually nearer in length to a short sword for a normal person, but a lethal weapon all the same, assuming it was a real sword. "A real sword it is," the Commendatore said pleasantly, as if reading my mind. His voice carried, despite his small stature. "Affirmative, it's small, but should you cut with it, blood will certainly come out." Even with this new information, I remained silent. No words came. My first thought was, oh, so he can talk? My next thought was that he sure had an odd way of speaking. It was not the way ordinary people would speak. But then again, the little 2-foot Commendatore was in no way ordinary. So whatever his manner of speech, it shouldn't be surprising. "In Tomohiko Amata's Killing Commendatore, it is indeed me who is impaled by a sword and dies a pitiful death," the Commendatore said. "As my friends are well aware. But have I any wounds that you can see?" "Negative. No wounds at all. It would be a bother for me to traipse around bleeding, and it would certainly annoy my friends as well. What with blood messing up the carpet and furniture and whatnot. So I left out the stab wound. The one who took the killing out of Killing Commendatore, that's me, affirmative. If you need a name for me, my friends can call me the Commendatore." The way the Commendatore spoke was odd, but he wasn't a poor speaker. In fact, he was actually pretty talkative. But I still couldn't get a single word out. Reality and unreality still hadn't come to a mutual understanding inside me. "Perhaps you will put that stick down," the commendatore said. "It is not as though we are about to embark upon a duel." I looked at my right hand. It was still clutching Amada's walking stick tightly. I let it go. The oak stick made a dull clunk as it struck the carpet. "It is not like I escaped from the painting," the commendatore said, again reading my mind. "Negative. That painting, a fascinating one, by the way, remains intact. The commendatore is still in the process of being stabbed to death. A huge amount of blood continues to flow from his heart. All I have done is borrow his shape for a while. I need some sort of shape in order to speak with my friends. So, for the sake of convenience, I borrowed his form. Is that acceptable to my friends?" Still, not a peep from me. "Not that anybody really cares. Mr. Amada has gone on to a hazy, peaceful world, and the commendatore is not trademarked. If I had appeared as Mickey Mouse or Pocahontas, the Walt Disney Company would be only too happy to slap me with a huge lawsuit. But if I am the commendatore, I think we are safe, my friends." The commendatore's shoulders shook as he laughed merrily. "I would have been okay as a mummy, but if I'd appeared as a mummy all of a sudden in the middle of the night, I am aware that my friends might have been bothered. To see a man all shriveled up like a hunk of beef jerky ringing a bell in the middle of the night, that would certainly give most people a heart attack." I nodded almost automatically. True enough, a commendatore was much preferable to a mummy. If he'd been a mummy, I might really have had a heart attack. But running across Mickey Mouse or Pocahontas ringing a bell in the dark would have been pretty creepy, too. A commendatore dressed in Oscar period costume probably was a better choice. "Are you a kind of spirit?" I ventured to ask. My voice was hard and hoarse, like a convalescence. "An excellent question," the commendatore said. He held up a tiny, white index finger. "An excellent question indeed, my friends. What am I? I am now, for the time being, the commendatore. Nothing other than the commendatore. But this form is but temporary. I do not know what I will be next. What am I to begin with? Or I could say, what are you, my friends? My friends have your own appearance, but what are you to begin with? If you were asked that same question, my friends might indeed be confused, I imagine. It is the same thing with me." "Can you assume any form you like?" I asked. "No, it is not that simple. The forms I can take are quite limited. I can't take any form I want. There is a limit to the wardrobe. I cannot take on a form unless there is a necessity for it. And the form I could choose now was this pint-sized commendatore. I had to be this small because of the way he was painted. But this attire is highly unpleasant to wear, I am afraid." He began squirming around in his white costume. "To return to the pressing question that my friends have pondered, am I a spirit? No, it is nothing like that. I am no spirit. I am just an idea. A spirit is basically supernaturally free, which I am not. I live under all sorts of restrictions." I had plenty of questions, or rather, I should have had. But for some reason I couldn't think of a single one. Why did he address me as my friends? But that was trivial, not worth asking about. Maybe in the world of an idea, there was no second person singular. "I have so many kinds of detailed limitations," the commendatore said. "For instance, I can only take on form for a limited number of hours each day. I prefer the somewhat dubious middle of the night, so mostly shapeshift between 1:30 and 2:30 a.m. It's too tiring to do it during the day. When I don't have form, I take it easy, as a formless idea, here and there. Like the horned owl in the attic. Also, I cannot go where I am not invited. Whereas when my friends opened the pit and took out the bell for me, I was able to enter this house. So you were stuck at the bottom of the pit all this time? I asked. My voice had improved, but it was still a bit hoarse. I could not say. I do not have memory in the exact sense of the term, though my being stuck in the pit is a fact. I was in the pit and could not escape, but it did not feel inconvenient to me being shut up in there. I could be stuck in a cramped, dark hole for tens of thousands of years and not feel any distress. I am grateful to my friends for getting me out of there. Being free is much more interesting than not being free, needless to say. I am also grateful to that Mr. Menshiki. Without his efforts, the hole never would have been opened up. I nodded. That's exactly right. I think I must have sensed it. The possibility that the pit would be exhumed, I mean, and must have thought this. The time has come. So it was you who began to ring the bell in the middle of the night? Precisely. And the pit was opened, and Mr. Menshiki very kindly invited me to his dinner party. I nodded again. It was true that Menshiki had invited the Commendatore, though he'd used the word mummy, to dinner on Tuesday. Following the example of Don Giovanni's dinner invitation to the bronze statue of Il Commendatore. To him, it was probably a bit of a joke, but this was no longer a joke. I never take any food, the Commendatore said, and I do not drink either. No digestive organs, you see. 'Tis boring if you think about it, since he has gone to the trouble of preparing such a feast, but still I went ahead and accepted. It is not often that an idea is invited by someone for dinner. These were the Commendatore's last words that night. He suddenly grew silent and quietly shut both eyes, as if slipping into a meditative state. With his eyes closed, the Commendatore's features took on a contemplative look. His body, too, was completely still. His whole form began to fade, the outline becoming indistinct, and a few seconds later, he totally vanished. Reflexively, I glanced at the clock. 2:15 a.m. Most likely, his materialization had reached its time limit. I went over to the sofa and touched the spot where the Commendatore had sat. My hand felt nothing, no warmth, no depression, no evidence at all that anyone had sat there. Ideas most likely had no body heat or weight. That figure was a mere image and nothing more. I sat down next to where he'd been, took a deep breath, and rubbed my face hard. It felt like it had taken place in a dream. I must have been having a long, very vivid dream. Or maybe this world now was an extension of the dream, one I was shut up inside. But I knew this was no dream. This might not be real, but it wasn't a dream either. Menshiki and I had released the Commendatore, or an idea taking the appearance of the Commendatore, from the bottom of that strange pit. And that Commendatore, like the horned owl in the attic, had come to inhabit this house. I had no clue what that meant, or what it would lead to. I stood up, retrieved Tomohiko Omada's walking stick I'd dropped on the floor, turned off the light in the living room, and returned to my bedroom. It was quiet all around, not a single sound. I took off my cardigan, slipped back into my bed in my pajamas, and lay there thinking about what I should do now. The Commendatore planned to go to Menshiki's house on Tuesday, since Menshiki had invited him to dinner. And what would happen there? The more I thought about it, the more wobbly my brain became, my mind like a dining table with uneven legs. But before long, I grew overpoweringly sleepy, like every function of my brain was mobilizing to put me to sleep, to pluck me by force from an incoherent, confused reality. And I couldn't resist. Before long, I fell asleep. Just before I fell asleep, I thought of the horned owl. How is he doing? My friends must go to sleep now. It felt like the Commendatore murmured this into my ear. But that must have been part of a dream. Chapter 22. The invitation is still open. The next day was Monday. When I woke up, the digital clock showed 6:35. I sat up in bed and reviewed the middle-of-the-night happenings in the studio. The bell ringing, the miniature Commendatore, the strange conversation with him. I wanted to believe it was all a dream. I'd had a very long, real dream. That's all it was. In the light of morning, that's the only way I could see it. I clearly remembered everything that had taken place, and the more I reviewed each and every detail, the more it felt like something that had happened light years away from reality. But no matter how hard I tried to see it all as a dream, I knew that it wasn't. This might not have been real, but it wasn't a dream. I didn't know what it was, but at any rate, it wasn't a dream. It was something altogether different. I got out of bed, removed the washi paper wrapping from Tomohiko Amada's Killing Commendatore, and carried the painting into the studio. I hung it on the wall, then sat on the stool and studied the painting. Like the Commendatore had said the previous night, nothing about the painting had changed. The Commendatore hadn't escaped from the painting into this world. Like always, the Commendatore was still there, stabbed in the chest, blood pouring out of his heart as he died. He looked up in the air, his mouth open in a grimace, groaning in agony. His hairstyle, the clothes he wore, the long sword he held, even the strange black shoes were exactly those of the Commendatore who'd appeared here last night. No, to put it in the correct order, chronologically speaking, naturally last night's Commendatore had minutely copied the appearance of the Commendatore in the painting. It was astounding that the fictional figure that Tomohiko Amada had painted with a Japanese paintbrush and pigment had taken on real form and appeared in reality, or something like reality, moving around under its own willpower in three-dimensional form. But as I stared at the painting, this phenomenon began to seem less and less impossible. That's how vivid and alive Tomohiko Amada's rendering was. The longer I looked at the painting, the less clear was the threshold between reality and unreality, flat and solid, substance and image. Like Van Gogh's mailman, who, the longer you looked, seemed to take on a life of his own. Same with the crows that he painted. Nothing but rough, black lines, but they really did seem to be soaring through the sky. As I gazed at Killing Commendatore, I was struck once again with admiration for Amada's gift and craftsmanship as an artist. No doubt that the Commendatore, or idea, I should say, was equally struck by how amazing and powerful the painting was, and that was why he had borrowed the appearance of the Commendatore. Like a hermit crab chooses the prettiest and most sturdy shell to live in. I studied Killing Commendatore for some 10 minutes, then went into the kitchen, brewed coffee, and, while listening to the regular news broadcast on the radio, had a simple breakfast. The news was meaningless. Or what I should say is that almost none of the news those days held any meaning for me. Still, listening to the 7 a.m. news each day had become part of my routine. It might be a problem if the world was on the brink of destruction, and I was the only person unaware of it. I finished breakfast, and after confirming that that Earth, despite all its various troubles, was still spinning away, I headed back to the studio, mug in hand. I drew back the curtain to let in some fresh air, then stood before the canvas and went back to work on my painting. Whether the Commendatore's appearance was real or not, whether he showed up at Manshiki's dinner or not, all I could do in the meantime was focus on the work at hand. I called to mind the figure of the middle-aged man with the white Subaru Forester. On his table in the restaurant had been a car key with the Subaru logo, a heap of toast, scrambled eggs, and sausage on a plate. Ketchup, red, and mustard, yellow, containers sat alongside. Knife and fork were lined up on the table. He'd yet to start eating. Morning light shone on the whole tableau. As I passed him, the man raised his suntanned face and stared at me. "I know exactly where you've been and what you've been up to," he was informing me. I recognized that heavy, dispassionate light abiding in his eyes. A light I may have seen somewhere else, though when or where I couldn't say. I was completing that figure and that wordless message in the form of a painting. I started out using a crust of bread as an eraser to get rid of any excess lines from the charcoal framework I'd sketched the day before. After removing all that I could, I again added some lines in black to the black lines that remained. This process took an hour and a half. What emerged on the canvas was, so to speak, a mummified image of the man who drove the white Subaru Forester. The flesh pruned away, the skin dried up like beef jerky, a figure shrunken one whole size. This was depicted through the rough black charcoal lines alone. Just a preliminary sketch, but I could imagine how it linked up with the full painting to come. "Nicely done," the Commendatore said. I spun around. The Commendatore was seated on the shelf near the window, facing me, his silhouette distinctly backlit in the morning light. He had on the same ancient white clothes and the same long sword downsized to fit his height. "This is no dream. Of course it isn't," I told myself. "I am no dream, I can tell you. Negative, of course," the Commendatore said, once again reading my thoughts. "I am closer to wakefulness than dream." I said nothing. From my perch on the stool, I gazed at his silhouette. "I think I said this last night, but it is pretty exhausting for me to materialize when it is bright out like this," the Commendatore said. "But I wanted to watch my friend's painting just this once, so I took the liberty of observing while you worked. I hope this does not offend you." I had no answer to this either. Whether it offended me or not, how was a real person supposed to reason with an idea? Not waiting for my response, or maybe taking what was in my mind as my response, the Commendatore continued. "You are quite a talented painter. Stroke by stroke, the essence of that man is coming out on that canvas." "Do you know something about him?" I asked, surprised. "Affirmative," the Commendatore said. "Of course I do." "Then could you tell me something about him? What kind of person he is, what work he does, what he's doing now?" "I wonder," the Commendatore said, slightly inclining his head, a hard look coming over his face. When he made that sort of expression, he looked like a goblin, or like Edward G. Robinson from an old gangster movie. Who knows, maybe the Commendatore had borrowed that expression from Edward G. Robinson. That wouldn't be impossible. "There are things in the world my friends are better off not knowing," the Commendatore said. The Edward G. Robinson look plastered on his face. "The same thing Masahiko Amada had said the other day," I recalled. "There are things people are better off not knowing." In other words, you won't tell me the things I'm better off not knowing, I said. Affirmative. Even if you hear it from me, the truth is that my friends already know it. I was silent. As my friends paint that picture, you will be subjectively giving form to what my friends already comprehend. Think of Thelonious Monk. Thelonious Monk did not get those unusual chords as a result of logic or theory. He opened his eyes wide and scooped those chords out from the darkness of his consciousness. What is important is not creating something out of nothing. What my friends need to do is discover the right thing from what is already there. So he knew about Thelonious Monk. Affirmative. And of course I know Edward, whatchamacallit, too, the Commendatore said, grabbing hold of my thoughts. No matter, the Commendatore continued. Ah, there is one thing I must raise at this point as a matter of courtesy. It is about your lovely girlfriend. Right, the married woman who drives a red car. Apologies, but I have been watching all you have been doing here. What you all enjoy doing in bed after you take off your clothes. I stared at him without a word. What we enjoy doing in bed, to borrow her words for it, what one hesitates to mention. But you really should not mind. My apologies, but an idea watches everything that happens. I cannot choose what I watch, but there is nothing to worry about at all. Sex, radio exercise routines, chimney sweeping, it is all the same to me. Nothing that interesting to see. I just watch. There's no notion of privacy in the world of an idea? Affirmative, the Commendatore said, rather proudly. Not a speck of that. So if my friends do not mind, then that is all we need to say. So, are you okay with it? I shook my head slightly again. How about it? Was it possible to focus while having sex if you knew somebody else was watching the whole time? Could you call up a healthy sexual desire if you knew you were being observed? I have a question for you, I said. I would be happy to answer if I can, the Commendatore said. Tomorrow, on Tuesday, I'm invited to dinner at Mr. Menshiki's. And you're invited as well. Mr. Menshiki used the expression inviting a mummy, which actually means you, since at that point you hadn't yet appeared as the Commendatore. That does not matter. If I decide to be a mummy, I can do that in a flash. No, stay as you are, I said hurriedly. I would appreciate it if you stay the way you are. I will accompany you to Menshiki's house. You will be able to see me, but Menshiki will not, so it does not matter if I am a mummy or a Commendatore. Though there is one thing I would like my friends to do. And what would that be? My friends should call Menshiki now and make sure the invitation for Tuesday night is still open. When you do, make sure to say, it will not be a mummy coming with me that day, but the Commendatore. Would that still be all right? As I mentioned, I cannot set foot in a place unless I have been invited. The other party needs to invite me in some form or other, say, please come on in. Once I have been invited, then I can go whenever I feel like it. For this house, that bell over there acted as a substitute invitation. I see, I said. The one thing I couldn't have was him turning into a mummy. I'll call Mr. Menshiki, see if the invitation is still on, and tell him I'd like him to revise the guest list from mummy to Commendatore. Affirmative. I would be grateful. Receiving an invitation to a dinner party is quite unexpected. I have another question, I said. Weren't you originally a priest who undertook certain death austerities? A priest who voluntarily was buried underground, stopped eating and drinking, and chanted the sutras until you passed away? Didn't you die in the pit while you continued to ring the bell and eventually turned into a mummy? Hmm, the Commendatore said, and shook his head a little. Unclear. I can't say, really. At a certain point, I became a pure idea. But I have no linear memory of what I was before that, where I was, or what I did. The Commendatore was silent, staring fixedly into space. Anyway, I have to disappear soon, the Commendatore said in a quiet, slightly hoarse voice. The time during which I can materialize is nearly over. The morning is not my time. Darkness is my friend. A vacuum is my breath. I must be saying goodbye soon. So, thank you in advance for calling Mr. Menshiki. As if meditating, the Commendatore closed his eyes. His lips were tightly sealed, his fingers locked together, as he steadily grew fainter and then disappeared. Just like the night before, like fleeting smoke, he silently vanished in the air. In the bright morning sunshine, all that was left was me and the painting I'd started, the outline of the man with the white Subaru Forester glaring at me. I know exactly where you've been and what you've been up to. Afternoon, I called Menshiki. I realized this was the first time I'd ever phoned his home. He was the one who always called me. He picked up after 6 rings. I'm glad you called, he said. I was just about to call you, but I didn't want to bother you while you're working, so was waiting until the afternoon. I remember you mainly work in the morning. I just finished for the day, I said. Is it going well? Menshiki asked. Yes, I started a new painting, though I've barely begun. That's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear it. By the way, I hung the portrait you painted on the wall of my study, not yet framed. I'm letting it dry there. Even without a frame, it looks wonderful. About tomorrow, I said. I'll send a car to pick you up at 6, he said. The same car will take you back. It'll just be the two of us, so you don't need to dress up or bring a gift or anything. Please, just come as you are. There's one thing I wanted to check with you. Yes? The other day you said you wouldn't mind having a mummy join us for dinner, right? I did say that, yes. I remember. Is that invitation still open? Menshiki considered this for a moment, and then gave a cheery laugh. Of course it is. I meant what I said. The invitation is still open. Something happened, and the mummy won't be able to come, but instead the Commendatore says he'd like to. Is it all right to invite the Commendatore? Of course, Menshiki said without hesitation. Like Don Giovanni invited the statue to dinner, I would be pleased to have the Commendatore come to dinner in my humble abode. But unlike Don Giovanni in the opera, I haven't done anything so bad that I deserve to be thrown into hell. At least, I don't think I have. After dinner, I'm not going to be pulled into hell or anything, I hope. That won't happen, I replied. Though honestly, I wasn't all that confident. I couldn't predict any more what was going to happen next. Good. I'm not ready for hell quite yet, Menshiki said cheerily. As you might expect, he was taking it all as a clever joke. One question, though. As a dead person, Don Giovanni's Commendatore wasn't able to eat earthly food, but what about this Commendatore? Should I prepare food for him? Or does he not take any worldly food? There's no need to prepare food for him. He doesn't eat or drink. But it wouldn't be a problem if you set a place for him. Because he's basically a spiritual being? I believe so. An idea and a spirit were a little different, I thought, but I didn't want to get into it. I'm fine with that, Menshiki said. I'll make sure the Commendatore has his own seat at the table. It's an unexpected pleasure to be able to invite the famous Commendatore to dinner in my humble home. It's too bad, though, that he won't be able to sample the food. We'll have some delicious wine as well. I thanked Menshiki. Until tomorrow, then, Menshiki said, and hung up. That night, the bell didn't ring. The Commendatore must have been tired out from materializing during the day and answering my questions. Or maybe he no longer felt the need to summon me to the studio. At any rate, I slept a deep, dreamless sleep until morning. The next morning, as I painted in the studio, the Commendatore didn't make an appearance. So for 2 hours, I was able to forget everything and focus on painting. The first thing I did that day was paint over the outline, like spreading a thick slab of butter on toast. I started with a deep red, an edgy, offbeat green, and a grayish black. These were the colors the man wanted. It took a while to mix the right colors. As I went through this process, I put on the record of Mozart's Don Giovanni. With that music playing, it felt like the Commendatore would appear behind me at any minute, though he didn't. That day, Tuesday, the Commendatore, like the horned owl up in the attic, maintained a deep silence, but that didn't bother me particularly. As a flesh-and-blood person, I couldn't worry about an idea. Ideas had their own way of doing things, and I had my own life. I focused on completing The Man with the White Subaru Forester. Whether I was in the studio or out, standing before the canvas or not, the image of the painting was never far from my mind. According to the radio weather report, there was supposed to be heavy rain that night in the Kanto Tokai region, and off to the west, the weather was indeed taking a turn for the worse. In southern Kyushu, torrential rains had made rivers overflow, and people living in low-lying areas had had to evacuate. People in higher areas were warned to watch out for landslides. A dinner party on the night when it's going to be pouring, I thought. I thought of that dark hole in the middle of the woods. That weird stone-lined little chamber that Menshiki and I had exposed to the light of day when we moved the heavy rocks of the mound. I pictured myself sitting alone at the bottom of that pitch-dark hole, listening to rain pounding on the wooden cover. I'm shut up inside that hole, unable to escape. The ladder's been taken away, the heavy cover shut tight right above me, and everyone in the world has completely forgotten I've been left behind, or perhaps they think I'm long dead. But I am still alive, lonely, but still breathing. All I can hear is the downpour. There's no light. Not a single ray reaches me. The stone wall I'm leaning against is damply cold. It's the middle of the night. All sorts of bugs might ooze their way out. As this scene took shape in my mind, I gradually found it hard to breathe. I went out to the terrace, leaned against the railing, slowly breathed in the fresh air through my nose, and slowly exhaled through my mouth. As always, I counted the number of breaths and repeated this process at regular intervals. After repeating this for a while, I was able to breathe normally again. The twilight sky was covered in heavy, leaden clouds. The rain was getting closer. Menshiki's white mansion appeared faintly across the valley. This evening, that's where I'll be having dinner, I thought. Menshiki, me, and the famous Commendatore. Three of us seated around the dining table.
Affirmative. That is real blood I'm talking about, you know, the Commendatore whispered in my ear.
Chapter 23. They All Really Exist. When I was 13 and my little sister was 10, the two of us traveled by ourselves to Yamanashi Prefecture during summer vacation.
Our uncle on our mother's side worked in a research lab in a university in Yamanashi, and we went to stay with him. This was the first trip we kids had taken by ourselves. My sister was feeling relatively good then, so our parents gave us permission to travel alone. Our uncle was still young and single, and still is single even now, and had just turned 30, I think, at that time. He was doing research on genes, and still is, was very quiet and kind of unworldly, though a very open, straightforward person. He loved reading and knew everything about nature. He enjoyed taking walks in the mountains more than anything, which, he said, was why he took a university job in rural, mountainous Yamanashi. My sister and I liked our uncle a lot. My sister and I, backpacks in tow, boarded an express train at Shinjuku Station bound for Matsumoto and got off at Kofu. Our uncle came to pick us up at Kofu Station. He was spectacularly tall, and even in the crowded station, we spotted him right away. Our uncle was renting a small house in Kofu along with a friend of his, but his roommate was abroad, so we were given our own room to stay in. We stayed in that house for 1 week, and almost every day we took walks with our uncle in the nearby mountains. He taught us the names of all kinds of flowers and insects. We cherished memories of that summer. One day we hiked a bit farther and visited a windhole near Mount Fuji. Among the numerous windholes around Mount Fuji, there was one in particular that was fairly large. Our uncle told us about how these holes were formed. The caves were made of basalt, so inside you could hear hardly any echoes at all, he said. Even in the summer, the temperature remained low inside, so in the past, people would store ice they'd cut in winter inside the caves. He told us how they distinguished two types of holes. Fuketsu, the larger ones that were big enough for people to go inside, and Kazaana, the smaller ones that people couldn't enter. Both terms were alternate readings of the same Chinese characters, meaning wind and hole. Our uncle seemed to know everything. At the large wind hole, you paid an entrance fee and went inside. Our uncle didn't go with us. He'd been there numerous times, plus he was so tall and the ceiling of the cave so low, he'd end up with a backache. It's not dangerous, he said, so you two go on ahead. I'll stay by the entrance and read a book. At the entrance, the person in charge handed us each a flashlight and put a yellow plastic helmet on us. There were lights on the ceiling of the cave, but it was still pretty dark inside. The deeper we went inside the cave, the lower the ceiling got. No wonder our lanky uncle had bowed out. My kid sister and I shone the flashlights at our feet as we went in deeper. It was midsummer outside, but inside the cave it was chilly. It was 90 degrees Fahrenheit outside, but inside it was under 50. Following our uncle's advice, we both were wearing thick windbreakers we'd brought along. My sister held my hand tightly, either wanting me to protect her or else hoping to protect me, one or the other. Maybe she just didn't want to get separated. The whole time we were inside the cave, that small, warm hand was in mine. The only other visitors were a middle-aged couple, but they soon left, and it was just the two of us. My little sister's name was Komichi, but everyone in the family called her Komi. Her friends called her Michi or Michan. As far as I know, no one called her by her full name, Komichi. She was a small, slim girl. She had straight black hair, neatly cut just above her shoulders. Her eyes were large for the size of her face, with large pupils, which made her resemble a fairy. That day, she wore a white t-shirt, faded jeans, and pink sneakers. After we'd made our way deeper into the cave, my sister discovered a small side cave a little ways off from the prescribed path. Its mouth was hidden in the shadows of the rocks. She was very interested in that little cave. "Don't you think it looks like Alice's rabbit hole?" she asked me.
My sister was a big fan of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. I don't know how many times she had me read the book to her. Must have been at least 100. She had been able to read since she was little, but she liked me to read that book aloud to her. She'd memorized the story, but each time I read it, she still got excited. Her favorite part was the lobster quadrille. Even now, I remember that part, word for word. No rabbit, though, I said.
I'm going to peek inside, she said.
Be careful, I said. It really was a narrow, small hole, close to a kazaana in my uncle's definition, but my little sister was able to slip inside with no trouble. Her upper half was inside, just the bottom half of her legs sticking out. She seemed to be shining her flashlight inside the hole. Then she slowly edged backward, out of the hole.
It gets really deep in back, she reported. The floor drops off sharply, just like Alice's rabbit hole. I'm going to check out the far end.
No, don't do it. It's too dangerous, I said.
It's okay. I'm small, and I can get out okay.
She took off her windbreaker so that she was just wearing her t-shirt and handed the jacket to me along with her helmet. Before I could get in a word of protest, she'd wriggled into the cave, flashlight in hand. In an instant, she'd vanished. A long time passed, but she still didn't come out. I couldn't hear a sound.
Comey, I called out to her in the hole. Comey, are you okay?
There was no answer. Without any echo, my voice was sucked right up into the darkness. I was starting to get concerned. She might be stuck inside the hole, unable to move forward or back. Or maybe she had had a convulsion inside the hole and lost consciousness. If that had happened, I wouldn't be able to help her. All kinds of terrible scenarios ran through my head, and I felt choked by the darkness surrounding me. If my little sister really did disappear in the hole, never to return to this world again, how could I ever explain that to my parents? Should I run and tell my uncle, waiting outside the entrance? Or could I only sit tight and wait for her to emerge? I crouched down and peered into that tiny hole, but the beam from my flashlight didn't reach far. It was a tiny hole, and the darkness inside was overwhelming.
Comey!
I called out again. No response.
Comey!
I called out more loudly. Still no answer. A wave of cold chilled me to the core. I might lose my sister forever. She might have been sucked into Alice's hole and vanished. Into the world of the Mock Turtle, the Cheshire Cat, and the Queen of Hearts. A place where worldly logic doesn't apply. No matter what, we never should have come here. But finally, my sister did come back. She didn't back out like before, but crawled out head first. First, her black hair appeared from the hole, then her shoulders and arms. She wriggled out her waist, and finally her pink sneakers emerged. She stood in front of me, without a word, stretched, slowly took a deep breath, and brushed the dirt off her jeans. My heart was still pounding. I reached out and straightened up her disheveled hair. I couldn't make it out well in the weak light inside the cave, but there seemed to be dirt and dust and other things clinging to her white t-shirt. I put the windbreaker on over her and handed back the yellow helmet.
I didn't think you were coming back, I said, hugging her to me.
Were you worried?
A lot.
She grabbed my hand tightly again, and in an excited voice she said,
I managed to squeeze through the narrow part, and then deeper in it suddenly got lower, and down from there it was like a small room. A round room, like a ball. The ceiling's round, the walls are round, and the floor too. And it was so, so silent there. Like you could search the whole world and never find any place that silent.
like I was at the bottom of a deep ocean, in a hollow going even deeper. I turned off the flashlight and it was pitch dark, but I didn't feel scared or lonely. That room was a special place that only I'm allowed in. A room just for me. No one else can get there. You can't.